All right. Thank you. Thank you, Ban, for an awesome time of worship. Those songs, they do really mean much to me, and I think to some of you too. This morning, we'll be going back to Genesis 47, continuing on with Genesis 47. And the topic this morning will be Jacob's relationship with Pharaoh. It's kind of interesting because where we left off was chapter 46. And chapter 46 was the record of Jacob with 70 of his descendants going down to Egypt because of the severe famine. And we have learned that in chapter 46, there is this strange list of names. And in those names, it was God's way of giving us glimpses of what he's going to do in the end times. In the end times, it wasn't just a random list of names, but it was God's way always through genealogies, which we have seen so many times, that he's telling us something. And interestingly, chapter 46 will lead on to 47. I know I'm saying something so stupid, you know. Of course, after 46 is 47. But 47 is so much related to 46 because in 46 we are given so much more details about what's going to happen in the end times. And we talk about the end times, we may be like sitting in a theater and not even troubled by it. But today we should be troubled because you and I, we are looking at the end times. Last night, maybe some of you still do not know, while you and I, we were asleep, hundreds of aircraft, including some stealth bombers, went to Iran. Last night, three of their nuclear sites were bombed. Damage we don't really know. And this, we don't know again. We may be dragged into a big war. World War III, we don't know. But we do know one thing, that soon there will be a period which we call the tribulation. And if you look at the timeline, which we have looked at so often this past few months, this is a timeline of what's going to happen. The next big event is the rapture. You and I were waiting for the rapture, and that will kickstart the 7-year tribulation. Why am I talking about this instead of 47? We'll get to 47, but I'm quite troubled because there are today over the pulpit, many pastors are excited and they will quote verses, chapters, which may be out of chronological order. Chronological order. And we have said many times already that after the rapture, there will be a 7-year period where God is going to actually punish Israel and the world. But in particular, it was meant for Israel to turn the nation of Israel back to himself. And I will show you verses to back it up. Because many people, in fact, for myself, for the longest time, I always thought that, Jesus is going to come, there's a rapture, and that's the end of the world. It's not the end of the world. This world is going to remain during the millennium for 1,000 years. So, to put it all in perspective, what is happening today is the world is inching towards a major war, and that major war will cause many people to hate Jews even more. Today, you and I know the level of anti-Semitism is so high, so high. But the Bible tells us that for the tribulation to start, listen carefully, all the Jews must go back to Israel. All the Jews must go back to Israel. And you say, wow, there are more Jews outside Israel than in Israel today. It's true. But many will have to go back because anti-Semitism will force them to go back. And when they are back, Zechariah 13, verses 8 and 9, that's when God will begin to chasten, to discipline Israel. And in Zechariah 13, verses 8 and 9, tells us that during that period, that 7-year period, 2/3 of the population of Israel will be destroyed. They will be struck down. God will kill them because of their disobedience. They have been rebellious. Even today as we sit here, Israel has been rebellious. Only 1/3, Zechariah says, 1/3 will survive. But even 1/3, he will put through fire to refine them, to refine them. And not all the 1/3 will survive. Not only Zechariah speaks about this, but we find that also in one of the major passage speaking about the regathering of Israel. Today, God is going to regather them, bring them back to Israel. Ezekiel 20 gives us more details. Ezekiel chapter 20, this is one of the major passages if you want to find out. And very quickly, God says he's going to pour out his wrath. On who? On Israel. He's going to bring them back from all the nations, and he's going to bring them back to punish them. And in verse 38, God says, I will purge you. That means I will refine you, I will clean you up, and he will remove all those who revolt and rebel against him. This is speaking about Israel, but it applies to the world as well. Anything that happens to Israel will also happen to the world. Israel is just a microcosm, a small picture of what is going to happen to the world. But notice here, God says, you won't enter the land. You will be somewhere near. And in Ezekiel chapter 20, God says, just as I've punished your ancestors in the wilderness, they have not entered the promised land yet. Just as I've punished them, and many died in the wilderness, God says, so you will also die outside of Israel. But two chapters down, Ezekiel 22 tells us, the 1/3, he's going to gather them into the midst of Jerusalem. This 1/3 will go into Jerusalem. And the verse 21, God says, I will gather you, Israel, and blow on you with the fire of my wrath. That is judgment. It is not the promised land, even though they are in the promised land, but they are still facing the wrath of God. So I want you to understand all this, that the tribulation is actually to punish Israel for their rebellion. In the same way, God will punish all the Gentile nations for their disobedience. But during this tribulation period, even with those Jews that have returned to Israel, when the tribulation starts, what do you think they will do? They will sit there and, okay, beat me, beat me. Do you think that's what they will do? No. They will run. They will run out of Israel to all the surrounding nations. And this is where another familiar passage where it is so much quoted and yet misunderstood. Because in Isaiah chapter 11, verse 11, Isaiah 11:11, God said that in that day the Lord will reach out his hand a second time to bring back the remnant of his people. Who is this remnant? Those one third. And where did they go? They went to Assyria, northern Egypt, southern Egypt, Ethiopia, Elam, Babylonia, Hamath, and all the distant coastline. I place there those in blue. Those are the present day names. But the key word is not just that he will regather them, but he will regather them a second time. Meaning during the tribulation, that 7-year period, they all ran away. And God had to bring them back at the end of the 7 years. Jesus will come and physically be on earth, and he will regather them. He will bring them back for the millennium. This is what it means, a second time. Many people have speculated that, oh, second time refers to the 70-year exile when God brought them back. The first one was the Exodus. It's not true. Many prophecies have got near-term fulfillment. There may be many near-term fulfillments, but it all points to a final fulfillment, which is just before the millennium. Jesus will regather them a second time. But we know that at the end of the millennium, even though under the righteous rule of Jesus, the whole world will want to rebel. They will reject the rule and they refuse to submit to Jesus, even while he was on earth. And there will be the final battle at the end of the 1,000 years. We call it the Battle of Gog and Magog. Who are the key players? We know from Ezekiel 38. This is where a lot of people are quoting from today. Ezekiel 38. The Ezekiel 38 is speaking about what's going on in the millennium. And here in chapter 38, we are given the identity of the enemies of Israel. And the names may not be familiar, but we know their modern equivalent. And if we look at Genesis chapter 10, the table of the nations, the names are there, all right? And we do know who they are today. They are basically, Gog is Russia, which most of us would think, and then Persia, Cush, Put, and Gomer, Beth, Togarma. They are Iran, ancient Ethiopia, northern part of Africa, Libya, and today, and many of the nations surrounding the Black Sea today. I'm just going through very quickly so that you, when you talk and you listen to people, you understand the chronological order and don't get it confused. So, where is it? Most of the nations around the Black Sea, it is nations like Georgia, East Turkey, Armenia, Azerbaijan. All right. So these are the names that you hear a lot today in the news. Let me just maybe show you a map that will be easier to see. Ah, okay. This is the table of nations. All right. Genesis chapter 10. The names are all given there. If you see the star here, this is where Israel is.
Can't even see, right? But yet,
at the final battle of Gog and Magog, the nations that will attack Israel are colored in red. I'm just going to stop here and hope that you understand the chronological order of events. And don't misquote scriptures, otherwise it will sound very silly. So, some of you may be saying, you know, really? I didn't know about all this and never heard about it. Can I just challenge you that this will be a good time for you all to get serious with Jesus and His Word? He tells us a lot of things about what's going to happen, and they are frightening. But when we are frightened, the question is, what would you do? The natural tendency is to run, is to hide. But are we to do that? Genesis 47 will tell us what we are to do. You see, God tells us everything. It's just that we don't see the connection between the chapters and the books. Right? Genesis, the book of Genesis, actually is the template for the whole Bible. Everything is a working out, unpacking of Genesis. And if you can see it that way, you'll be all right. And again, let me just quickly challenge you to spend time, invest your life studying the Word. This is the best time to study the Word. And some of you may be thinking, oh, that's tough. I just started on work. I got, you know, new families and tough to get time to study. If you want to enjoy the Scripture and fully understand all this, then you need time to study. It's kind of like if you enjoy sea sports and marine sports and you love the sea and all that, and you want to study more about the marine life, and you want to study about the different types of fish and corals and so forth. But if you keep wading in knee-deep water by the beach, all that you can see is just small little fish probably scuttering around your ankle. But if you want to know more, then you have to put on a snorkel and a pair of flippers, and then you can see the corals in deeper waters. But if you really want to learn a lot more about marine life, about sharks, dolphins, then you've got to get your scuba gear out, and you can go deep sea diving, and you can then dive deep. You cannot find a whale on a beach, only a dead whale. So this is where, interestingly, you think this is something I made up. Read Ezekiel 47. That's exactly what God is saying. You go knee deep, that's only your experience. If you go waist deep, you will have a deeper experience. But if you dive into the sea, you will get the whole experience. So this is what we're talking about today, and I hope to give you a quick update. All right, now we'll get into 47. 47, God is going to tell us that in the end times, what is it that you and I need to do? We're going to look at the first 12 verses, and it's going to be about Jacob's relationship with Pharaoh. And all the time when we read out the names, Jacob would represent Israel. Pharaoh would represent the kings of the world, of this world. So, we saw how Jacob was reunited with Joseph. And after a very emotional reunion, Joseph must now inform Pharaoh of his family's arrival in Goshen and wanting to separate his family from the Egyptians. Joseph also must justify to Pharaoh why his family must occupy the area of Goshen. So this is where we pick up chapter 47, verse 1 and 2. Joseph went and told Pharaoh, "My father and brothers, with their flocks and herds, and everything they own, have come from the land of Canaan, and are now in Goshen." He chose five of his brothers and presented them before Pharaoh. Why five? I don't know. All right. Joseph presented only five. Perhaps he thought that five is big enough to represent the rest of the brothers. Verses 3 and 4. Pharaoh asked the brothers, "What is your occupation?" "Your servants are shepherds," they replied to Pharaoh, "just as our fathers were." They also said to him, "We have come to live here for a while, because the famine is severe in Canaan, and your servants' flocks have no pasture. So now, please let your servants settle in Goshen." Now the brothers replied exactly as Joseph had instructed them, and they have even requested for Pharaoh's approval to settle in Goshen. Then Pharaoh replied, verses 5 and 6. Pharaoh said to Joseph, "Your father and your brothers have come to you, and the land of Egypt is before you. Settle your father and your brothers in the best part of the land. Let them live in Goshen. And if you know of any among them with special ability, put them in charge of my own livestock." So it shows here that Pharaoh actually had not just cows, he has got sheep and goats as well. After hearing the brothers' story, Pharaoh did exactly as Joseph had hoped for and commanded Joseph to give them the best part of the land in Goshen. And furthermore, some of the brothers were promoted. They became Pharaoh's official herdsmen. Verses 7 and 8. Then Joseph brought his father Jacob in and presented him before Pharaoh. After Jacob blessed Pharaoh, Pharaoh asked him, "How old are you?" Now there's a lot in these two verses. Just a casual glance wouldn't really surface it. But you and I know that after Joseph had presented this old and frail father of his, Jacob, before Pharaoh, who is the king of one of the most powerful empire at that time. And without warning, Jacob proceeded to bless Pharaoh. You might think, what's wrong with that? But by blessing Pharaoh first, Jacob made what appeared to be an embarrassing mistake in palace protocol, or even in any social setting. It is an embarrassment. Why? Well, what is the significance of for one person to bless the other? Today we use that word very loosely, don't we? When I meet people, like last night, somebody said to me, "God bless you," all right? And I look at him, and I usually, if I'm a bit nasty, I will say, "How do you know? How do you know God will bless me?" All right? That's why people don't want to say they bless me. So what is the significance? What is the significance for one person to bless the other? We need to understand the meaning of this word. In the Hebrew, it means wishing him good health and happiness. But really, it is also an authoritative way, just as a prophet or a patriarch, a man who is divinely inspired by God to pronounce a blessing, a prayer for another person. That is what it means in Hebrew. But when we get to the New Testament, usually the word blessed would mean is the Greek word eulogio. Eulogio. It means to speak well of, with praises, with thanksgiving. Quite a general word, but that's again where we get our English word eulogy. Alright? Eulogy. So we're still left with the question: was Jacob's blunder due to his ignorance of palace etiquette? If it was, why didn't Joseph prepare his father for this meeting, just as he prepared his brothers? Because he would know that Jacob's habit is to bless people. This must have surprised Pharaoh. It must have shocked him and all the other court officials who were there in the palace, and because they were expecting the king to bless Jacob, which was the normal practice. Why was it normal? Because we know that only the greater is able to bless the lesser. And you would remember the time in Genesis chapter 43 verse 29 when they brought Benjamin to Egypt, and that was the time when Joseph blessed Benjamin when he said, God be gracious to you, my son. More importantly, it is God himself who also confirmed this basic principle that only the greater can bless the lesser. In Hebrews chapter 7 verses 6 and 7. Hebrews chapter 7 verses 6 and 7. Verse 6 reads, referring to Melchizedek, this man, however, did not trace his descent from Levi, yet he collected a tenth from Abraham and blessed him who had the promises. And without doubt, the lesser is blessed by the greater. Melchizedek is actually a Christophany, Jesus appearing in the Old Testament time, and he did not descend from the tribe of Levi, and he had the right to collect an offering from Abraham. So now that we know this, that only the greater can bless the lesser, was it a blunder on Jacob's part? If it was not, then it means that Jacob knew exactly what he was doing. And if Jacob is the greater than Pharaoh, the next question is, what gave Jacob this honor? Or who gave Jacob this privilege to bless Pharaoh? And you and I know that it is God. It is God that who gave Jacob this honor, this privilege, because God now calls Jacob Israel, the patriarch chosen by God, to bring the Messiah into this world. And only Jesus is the real blessing to the whole world. So having that in mind, Jacob understands his position before God with dignity as the representative of Yahweh. Jacob pronounced a blessing on Pharaoh. Just a quick contrast between this Jacob and Jacob some years back. You remember when he met Esau on his way back from Paddan Aram. When he met Esau, we saw him bowing down to Esau 7 times, groveling with his nose in the sand. That was the former Jacob. But today, Jacob carried himself as a child of God should. But he did not forget. He didn't forget that he was also the servant and ambassador of the King of Kings. So when Jacob took the initiative to bless Pharaoh, rather than allowing Pharaoh to bless him, that was actually Jacob's way of saying that the God of Jacob is blessing Pharaoh and Egypt. How? By the very presence of Jacob and his tribe in their land. Beginning with Joseph. They all knew what Joseph did for Egypt. But yet, this was a very awkward moment, as Pharaoh must have been stunned by Jacob's reversal to take the higher position. How can this old frail man take the higher position, considering the fact that Jacob and his family are now in Egypt seeking shelter from the severe famine, and they are now in Egypt at the invitation and at the kindness of Pharaoh? You get the picture now, all right? It's really awkward. In fact, Jacob and his family are very much like refugees seeking food and shelter, like desperate victims we see today on our TV. Victims of an earthquake, or those who are fleeing from a civil war. Now, even though Jacob and his family may certainly look like famine-stricken refugees, but they are not beggars. They are not beggars. And he did not behave like one, because spiritually, Jacob was greater than Pharaoh. So the question is, how did Jacob get to be spiritually greater? What did he do to be spiritually greater? The next few verses will tell us more. But before we get into those verses, let's just pause to take a lesson from Jacob. What is it about Jacob that God would want us to learn from him? And I believe that it is this: that like Jacob, you and I must never forget that we are children of the Most High God. Therefore, we are also spiritually greater than the most powerful man, than the richest man, than the most famous man. And like Jacob, we too can offer people around us, our friends and our family, the special blessing that you and I possess. And that blessing is Jesus Christ. Only Jesus. So Pharaoh was stunned, shocked. And in verse 8, we read something
another strange question. Pharaoh asked him, "How old are you?" It doesn't seem to connect or related. But Pharaoh asked him, "How old are you?" Verses 9 and 10. And Jacob said to Pharaoh, "The years of my pilgrimage are 130. My years have been few and difficult, and they do not equal the years of the pilgrimage of my fathers." Then Jacob blessed Pharaoh and went out from his presence. He blessed Pharaoh again. But notice Pharaoh's question to Jacob. It sounded a bit odd, don't you think? Especially to the Western culture, because you would not expect someone to ask for your age, especially at the first meeting. But in the ancient times, especially in the Middle Eastern culture, and probably also in our Asian culture, age is used to determine a hierarchy, a pecking order, a ranking in a social setting. Is that not true? How many of you at your first meeting, people would ask you, "How old are you?" Nobody. Maybe they can guess. They look at me, and say, "You're too old," you know. But it is also in our Asian culture. Besides age, if a person is married and have children, that will also add to a person's ranking, which gives that person more right, more authority to speak up in a social setting. Simply put, the words of an elder or a person who's married and have children. So in that order, if you're older, that's fine. But if you're younger and you're married, you rank higher. And if you're married, no children, then you remain there. But if you have children, then your ranking is very high. Why would Pharaoh ask him such a question? I personally believe that Pharaoh was just being very nice. And he was trying to be diplomatic for this mess that Jacob has created. He was trying to make an excuse for Jacob's action when he blessed Pharaoh. Jacob came back with an equally odd answer. He began by saying that he's 130 years old, which is true, he was 130. But the second part of verse 9 is strange, because he said, "My years have been few and difficult, and they do not equal the years of the pilgrimage of my fathers." Meaning, at 130, compared to Abraham and Isaac, who lived much longer, Abraham died at 175, Isaac died at 180. But Jacob went on to say, "My life has been few and difficult." In the NIV, it reads difficult. In your King James, it would read evil, evil. In the NASB, it's unpleasant. All those three words are true. But why would Jacob say all this? What he was trying to say is that his life is filled with miseries. But it was also equally true that his life was filled with his own sinful behavior. And because of his sinful behavior,
it brought about a lot of trouble on himself. Jacob knew by now that his miseries were due to his own sinfulness, because he often chose to obtain God's blessings through his own effort. Scheming, deception, meaning Jacob always desires the right thing. He desires spiritual things, but he is always doing it in the wrong way. Jacob started his scheming, as you would know, right from the mother's womb. And then he went on to deceive his father Isaac, stole his brother Esau's birthright, and then he was forced to run away to uncle Laban. And to top his list of miseries, his favorite wife, Rachel, died very young. That was number one for him. So, in his reply, Jacob may also be comparing and contrasting his life with his father Isaac and grandpa Abraham. Because if you look at Isaac and Abraham, each of them, they were blessed with a beautiful wife, and they were rich, and they lived relatively a carefree life, and they both died in the promised land. But for Jacob, comparatively, Jacob had to spend 20 years in Padan Aram, and then now he has to die in Egypt. Why would, in front of Pharaoh, Jacob paint such a negative picture of himself? Why would Jacob say all these negative things? Does it sound like he's putting himself down? No. But by speaking about his own sinfulness, Jacob is actually telling Pharaoh, and he's making it clear that his spiritual advantage over Pharaoh, his honor and his right to bless Pharaoh, did not come from his age or some personal achievements. And he's also not putting himself down to make a show of false modesty. But that's the truth. He spoke the truth in humility, because God has broken him. God has broken him. You remember he wrestled with the angel, and then he lost. So Jacob now fully understands that his personal worth, his honor, his position before man is superior, but is based on his relationship and tied to the covenant God gave first to Abraham, then to Isaac, and now it is being passed on to him. That's the Abrahamic covenant. Three main parts. God promised to give them a land, people, and the blessing. The land will be through only the line of Jacob. And the land is Canaan. And then the blessing, it is in and through Jesus Christ. He is the ultimate blessing. No other man, no other family on planet Earth right now has this promise. It was made only to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And that's why today, as we look at what's happening in this world, there are many who try to wipe Israel off the map. It will not happen. They are still in existence today because of this promise. John Nelson Darby once wrote, "The list and the most faltering of God's children has the superiority in the presence of the most elevated man of the world. You and I, as a child of God, we are more superior than any of the most powerful men, the richest men on planet Earth. And we will understand a little bit more about this when we get into our next study, when we get to the second part of chapter 47. Today we are only looking at Jacob's relationship with Pharaoh. But next week we'll be looking at Joseph's relationship with the Egyptians. And that will tie in into what God would want us to do when the world is in chaos, when the world is heading towards a big war. But when we look at Joseph's relationship with the Egyptians, we must understand that Joseph is a foreshadow of Jesus. And we'll be looking at the relationship of Jesus with the rest of the world. So that is what it is all about. So back to Jacob. We see how Jacob, he has conducted himself with dignity before Pharaoh, not just as a child of the Almighty Creator God, but Jacob was also an ambassador sent to Egypt representing Yahweh. One day, maybe you already have, one day God may place us before rich, powerful, or famous men and women. They may be our bosses. They may be even our family or friend or people we don't want to offend at the risk of losing a business deal, losing a job, or even losing a family relationship. But like Jacob, when the time and opportunity comes for you, the question is, would you stop elevating yourself and take courage to speak to them of the blessing that they too can have? And that blessing is none other than Jesus Christ. Would you have that courage? Would you do it when the time and opportunity comes? Some of us really have the habit of trying to impress other people. Oh, I'm this, I'm that. I've been to Harvard, you know, and I met with the king in London. And you try to drop names. Stop elevating ourselves and lift up the name of Jesus. Another interesting thing to note here is that Jacob described his life as a pilgrimage. A pilgrimage. How many of you have been to a pilgrimage? None of us, all right? Some of us think that, oh, if I go to Israel, it's my spiritual pilgrimage. It's not. You went there to buy souvenirs, all right? But Jacob described his life as a pilgrimage. And if you ask me about his life, as we look at Jacob's life, I think his life looks more like a rat race. Or at best, a battle. A never-ending battle. Which is also much like most of our lives today. Because the word pilgrimage would give us the impression that Jacob's life was serene, trouble-free, and he was on a calm spiritual journey towards a sacred destination. That doesn't look like Jacob's life, but Jacob was correct to describe his life that way, because Hebrews 11 verse 9 says, by faith he made his home in the promised land, like a stranger in a foreign country. He lived in tents, as did Isaac and Jacob, who were heirs with him of the same promise. speaking about Abraham. Abraham has always looked at his life as a stranger in a foreign land. And all his life, Abraham lived in a tent. Nothing permanent, because he knows it is not permanent. And Jacob also pictured himself here as a traveler on a journey, living in tents, just passing through this world to his permanent home, to a city that God built. Jacob had many flaws and failings, and we are no different. Yet God was able to use him to bring a blessing to Pharaoh and all Egypt. So Jacob blessed Pharaoh again in verse 10 and left the palace. Verses 11 and 12. So Joseph settled his father and his brothers in Egypt and gave them property in the best part of the land, the district of Ramesses, as Pharaoh directed. Joseph also provided his father and his brothers and all his father's household with food according to the number of their children. So here we're told Joseph moved his whole family to Egypt, and he had to segregate them, separate them from the influences of the Egyptians. And he was able to protect and provide for his family, giving them enough food. Notice here, it is enough according to the number of their family. They didn't get extra. And yet they got the best part of the land for their livestock. Now, what do these two verses mean? Some Bible commentators would suggest that this is a picture of Israel entering the promised land and living a life of ease, because Joseph is now able to provide and protect them. But there is a problem here. How do we read Egypt as the promised land? We need to be consistent in our interpretation, meaning if one word cannot mean one thing here and then mean something else in another passage, there must be consistency in our interpretation. If we look at the Bible, Egypt has often come to symbolize our fallen world. This fallen world that we are living in now. And Jacob and his family would symbolize the nation of Israel. And at the same time, Israel would symbolize the rest of the world. So the question is, what then would this massive movement of 70 people from Canaan to Egypt, what does it symbolize? And the answer is this, that when God sent Jacob's family into Egypt, it symbolizes God's plan. God's plan to use the nation of Israel to represent him to the rest of the whole world. That is the meaning. But you and I know, Israel refused. Israel rejected God since the time of Moses and Joshua, right till the time of Jesus. They rejected him. So God now turned to use the Gentile church. That is, you and I. God wants to use us now. And now that Jesus has placed all of us in this world to be his witnesses, just as Joseph in verses 11 and 12 was able to provide for Jacob and his family and protect them, Jesus today will not only be able to protect and provide for our every need, but he has also given us the best of everything. if you seriously sit down and look at your own life, you have the best of everything. And while we are here on earth today, waiting eagerly for Jesus to come back, we must remember that we too, we do not belong to this world. We are not of this world. And we are not to share in their value system and their lifestyle. Yes, we are to remain separated from the world, but we are not to be isolated from the world. Why? So that we can be a blessing to the richest man, to the most powerful man, and to the most intelligent man, and tell them that they too need Jesus. So today, God having shown us that even though Jacob was spiritually greater than Pharaoh, that did not cause him to be arrogant. Instead, he obeyed God, went to Egypt, and he died there. He died there. Are you willing to do that? Because similarly, you and I, as children of the Most High God, we are spiritually greater than any man on planet Earth because of our relationship to Jesus. And like Jacob, we must never lower ourselves, never, in the presence of mere man. But we are to carry and conduct ourselves as a child of God because we are ambassadors of Jesus. Let me leave you with the words of Jesus. Matthew 28 verses 16 to 20. It is the great commission, the command of Jesus. And it's so familiar. Many of us have memorized this two verses, verses 19 and 20. But we've forgotten about the preceding verses. The preceding verses reads, verse 16, "But the 11 disciples proceeded to Galilee, to the mountain which Jesus had designated." In other translation, it will read the word "appointed." Jesus appointed and told them, "Go to this mountain in Galilee, and I'll meet you there." When you and I, we meet with Jesus, he appoints the place for us. We don't do that. Many of us today, we appoint our own places. In my bedroom, on my bed, with my laptop on my lap and a coffee in my right hand. Shame on us. But that's how we treat Jesus. But that's not how Jesus works. He appoints a place where he will meet us. And for Sundays, it is in the fellowship of believers. Fellowship of believers. Verse 17, "When they saw him, they worshipped him, but some were doubtful." Oh. What were they doubting about? That Jesus rose from the dead? No, they already saw him alive after the resurrection. There was no longer any doubt. What were they doubtful about? And the next three verses, Jesus gave them the command, the great commission. "All authority has been given to me in heaven and on earth. Go therefore and make disciples of all nations, baptizing them in the name of the Father and of the Son and of the Holy Spirit, teaching them to observe all things that I commanded you. And lo, I am with you always, even to the end of the age." We all know that. Three things Jesus said we need to do: go and make disciples, baptize them, and then teach them. Teach them all things that I've taught you. But some were doubtful. What is the meaning of this? we will pick this up in our next study. So, again, I put to you, these are the words of the Lord, our Lord Jesus. Let us continue to represent Jesus by faithfully and accurately preaching the gospel and making disciples of all the people we come into contact with, especially our family and our friends, telling them of the love of Jesus and the hope they too can have in Jesus alone. God bless.
In closing, I think from what we've heard from Pastor, one of the things that really struck me was how God has been gracious even to Joseph and his family. And he has indeed made this grace real in his family. And like 2 Corinthians 12:9 says that, you know, this grace is actually sufficient for all others, and his power is actually made perfect in our weakness, so that we can one day, therefore I will boast all the more gladly about my weakness, so that Christ's power may rest on me. Shall we close in the last song? Shall we rise in closing for the last song? Stronger.